Thank you very much for that. I also want to say I'm very pleased to be here. We're all very proud of Jockey, and we're looking forward to seeing how this interaction can blossom as we go forward. But thanks for having me. Right, so what am I trying to do? Today I'm going to be talking about the state market dichotomy. I guess it's an issue, it's a puzzle I've been trying to resolve in my work. I can't say I'm there yet. It's a journey. But it's a puzzle I find is present in the work of many of my contemporaries, because it speaks to an underlying problem in the way we study, in epistemologies, in the social sciences. This demarcation between disciplines, for instance, is a core element that reproduces the challenge of this dichotomy. So I'm going to start off today by going into a bit more depth about what I mean when I speak of the state market dichotomy. From then, I'm going to try to show manifestations of this dichotomy. I'm hoping others will recognize these as well. But we treat this as very normalized, I guess. So I think it's important to flag these up. And also why it's important to actually be discussing the state market dichotomy. What challenges does it present? Why should we be concerned about this? And then I'll move on to thinking about transcending the state market dichotomy in the work that we do. And also I'll move to how I have tried to address this in the work that I've done. And I want to wrap up with a very brief reflection on some African scholars that have inspired me in my journey, because I think that was supposed to be part of the ethos of this seminar series. So first of all, what's the state market dichotomy? Essentially, it's a tendency to conceptualize the state and the market as being very discrete, very separate entities, right? And not just that, with very limited reference to how they actually influence one another intrinsically. Yeah, so not in a superficial sense, but in their very underlying structures, in their nature, in their essence. How do these spaces influence one another? This is a major, I guess, issue around this. Ian Broff does a good job, I think, of expressing this dichotomy as where these entities are treated as discrete and autonomous parts and contain properties that are intrinsic to themselves, so unaffected by one another, and that they're relatively self-organizing elements of society. So again, detached from wider society and from one another. What I think is important to clarify also is that this concern is methodological as opposed to ontological. So I think when we all speak and when we discuss, we'll understand, especially when we go into empirical, reflections, examinations, it'll be very easy for me to explain to you why the state and the market are intrinsically interdependent on one another. That's clear and that's obvious. But when it comes to the study of these issues, there is a challenge with, in a sense, transmuting that understanding at an ontological level to an analytical level. I think, as I mentioned before, part of this is also a function of a discipline-based study of the world around us. Certainly, it's the case when we look at development and transition in Africa, as I have done. Right, it's very much reinforced by distinctions between economics and politics as subjects of study. Again, in reality, we understand how intrinsically interrelated these two are. But when we go into, hallowed halls of study like this one here, and these are treated in very separate space, this challenge is one that we then have to engage. Obviously, also when we are trained to study in particular disciplines, being able to transcend those boundaries becomes even more difficult, right? Actually having the skills to be able to engage, if you're an economist, engage, deep analysis of political, within political science can be a challenge. And I think these are some of the realities that make it very difficult to think beyond the mere recognition of this problem. Claude Ake, for instance, a prominent Nigerian scholar, was very clear that, in fact, the disciplinary boundaries that, in a sense, many scholars in Africa had inherited were very much unsuited to engaging realities on the African continent, right? And for him, he saw this, in a sense, as a colonial heritage that was making it very difficult for African scholars to engage their realities in ways in which that such analysis would actually progress debates on development and indeed transition. So how does it manifest? I think on the one hand, when we think of the orthodoxy, the orthodoxy for me would be in theoretical terms, as someone with an economics background, sort of neoclassical economics, but in ideological terms, debates around neoliberalism, because of the dominance of these discourses, I think we can accept that those, in a sense, define the orthodoxy, at least at this particular period in time. And there, I think it's quite clear. It's quite this dichotomy is quite clear. Within neoclassical economics itself, neoclassical economics depends on the understanding of the market as supreme to all other contexts in terms of its function of the allocation of resources efficiently, right? And so from that basis, it's quite clear that there is a sense that the market is the best space for the allocation of resources. What is especially interesting about this space is that not only is there recognition of this distinction between these entities in this way, but there is a sense in which they are positioned as rival mechanisms for resource allocation. Yeah. So that in a sense, there's an enmity between these spaces. So there are recent turns in within this space that recognize their coexistence, right? So you heard debates about the role of state as an enabler, but essentially, so even when we think of post-Washington consensus, we think of Justin Lin's work on the new structural economics, all of that. Fundamentally though, at the very base of it all, is the fact that the market continues to be the most efficient space for resource allocation, and it's only when there's an aberration of that perfect condition that we can imagine the role of another entity in these activities. And I think this is very essential. So this state market dichotomy is very much defined by market fundamentalism, but also by a sense of a crowding out effect, right? A sense that it isn't really possible for the state and the market to function together to drive transition and change, yeah? That there's a crowding out effect by having the state in that space. It's actually displacing the more efficient activities of the market. That's what I would argue underlies a lot of the thinking on this within the orthodoxy. But perhaps more surprising is that within the heterodoxy, so debates that actually recognize a significant role for the state in development, there continues to be this challenge with the state-market dichotomy, but in a different way. It's more nuanced, it's also less static, right? So that antagonism doesn't exist in quite the same way as you see it in the orthodoxy. So the, in a sense, the body of theory that I'm going to be engaging with, the developmental state paradigm, for instance, which has been very prominent in heterodox debates around the role of the state in development, very much drawing from what have been seen as successful experiences of East Asian economies, I think is an important space within which to explore this. So we see, for instance, Robert Wade, who is actually at the LSE, I believe, who carried out his Taiwan study that's been very influential for the developmental state paradigm, speaks of governing the market, right? So there is an understanding of the interaction between these spaces, yeah? So governing the market, essentially the state governing the market. And Chalmers Johnson, who's been very important in telling this story in the Japanese case, speaks of a very core ministry of international trade and industry and the Japanese economic miracle. So there again, you see this interaction between the state and the economic space, so the political element and the economic element. But what we find, even within those debates, is that the structural basis for the DSP is very much reliant on distinct schools. So they're interrelated schools, but they're quite distinct, the economic and the political. So the political school tends to focus more on the construct and the nature of the state. So factors that are seen, especially political factors that are seen as influencing that, particular histories of colonization, for instance, how Japanese colonization of Taiwan and South Korea influenced the structure of the state, for instance, comes to bear there. The experience of the military and governance has also been an important element. So these debates around authoritarian statehood, I think, is a debate that's coming to bear again when we think of Ethiopia, for instance, in the African context. So these are very much, but they're very contained, those conversations. Yeah. And in the economic school, the conversations there are more about the economic policies that are pursued by the state. So debates around the very construct of the state are kept separate. And the only discussion going on in the economic school are the sorts of policies that were carried out. So industrial policy, for instance, the ways in which many of these economies carried out protectionist trade policies, for instance. Yeah, these are the sorts of things that are discussed, but in a very discreet manner. So in a sense, I think we can think of the economic school as being concerned more with market dynamics and the political school more engaged with the state as a political entity, as though these were disparate situations. Why is this a challenge? Why should we care about this? Why do we need to move beyond this? I think it's important because the very analytical foundation here can ascribe abstract properties to the state and to the market, yeah, in a very disconnected way. And sometimes this can yield contradictory interpretations of empirical reality. So for me, something that's very striking, so the notion of state autonomy comes from the work of Peter Evans, that's seen as very definitive of developmental states, the ability of the state to, in a sense, be insulated from influences from wider society. So on the one hand, when we're speaking about this within the developmental state paradigm, this is a positive element. This is something that's supposed to imply that the state can focus on its own development agenda without being distracted by the needs of, for instance, the business elite, right? On the flip side, this notion of state autonomy, you know, I think can also be read within the rentier state thesis, right? So the sense in which rentier states are problematic because they are insulated also from the concerns of wider society. Yeah, and I think abstracting in this way and focusing only on analysis in these very separate spaces can drive such contradictory interpretations. Others have suggested that when we do this, and I think it links to the earlier point, it limits the comprehension of the interrelationship. And I think it also limits our understanding of empirical reality. Others have also suggested that, indeed, the structures of the state are definitely dependent on political processes and resources, right, of various constituencies within the market as well. And again, the treatment of this space as so discrete limits our understanding of these complexities. And especially within the African context, this comes about as being especially challenging. I think another key point, and one that's pertinent to our examination of the African context, is this unrealistic expectation of perfect markets, or indeed very strong and wise states. And in the work I did, when you actually go and revisit the East Asian experiences, this presentation of states that were impervious to elite interests, it's very difficult to find that in actual exploration of the empirical evidence. Yeah, these are interpretations that, because we're limited by the state-market dichotomy, we're forced to keep reproducing. Yeah. And then Radice, for instance, takes it further out. And the conversation now about the interaction of these spaces, the domestic space, with the global political economy. Now, in focusing so much on state and market as discrete spaces, it becomes difficult to think of markets beyond the domestic space. And we know that in many parts of the continent especially, the dynamics within the global markets are so powerful that they totally undermine the capacity for states in the domestic space to actually function. So it's, again, this is very problematic when we begin to introduce, or as we should, or position or locate these conversations within the global political economy dynamics. And I think the last point I want to make here that is especially significant is the fact that it impacts very negatively on the possibility of using the research analysis that we do to actually support transition, in terms of contributions, in terms of policy change. Because if we're working from a basis that actually doesn't speak to the lived realities of Africans and societies that we're dealing with, then it's no wonder that some of the interventions are, or a lot of the interventions, I would argue, are unable to really engage the complexity of those societies. So how do we actually transcend the state market dichotomy? Well, a first point has been made about how we do not transcend the state market dichotomy. And the idea of simply invoking or assuming a relationship between these two contexts is seen as very problematic. Yeah, and for me, I think that really suggests that there's a need for centering our understanding of empirical realities in those contexts. Yeah, this is not something that can be superimposed, but a need to actually go in depth to try and understand exactly what is going on in these spaces without necessarily presuming or being prescriptive about what we expect to happen. It is very difficult because, you know, scholars, we go in with a certain understanding, a certain lens to whatever we're looking at, and it's fine. I think as long as we recognize that, it's okay to go in with that and have the objective of trying to look at this from the bottom up, as it were. Again, Claude Ake, I think, suggests that being able to look at the relatedness of different elements in society, he especially privileges the notion of thinking about the interrelatedness of economic, social, and political and belief structures. So starting off with these categories, as it were. Ben Fine also argues that in order to comprehend the complex interrelated workings of these spaces, that it's important to reintroduce class, economic, and political interests more generally in order to examine how these are then represented across these two entities. So now I'm going to go into my own entry into this space and my experience of trying to transcend this state market dichotomy. First, I'll say my entry into this sphere of study was really to understand state-led development. So that was my lens. I was coming at it from the notion of the strong, wise state and how to understand the achievements of, you know, such strong, wise states. And my theoretical framing was the developmental state paradigm. And I think it's important to just flag that it has its own, the DSP has its intellectual foundations in classical development economic theory, so the work of scholars like Arthur Lewis, Paul Barron, really very much about the role of the state in driving industrial development, in driving structural transformation. It's very much at the heart of this, you know, post Second World War classic development theory. And also it has its basis sort of in the empirical reflections of the experiences of East Asian developmental states, so especially the first tier developmental states of Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea, but also some reflection on second tier developmental states like Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand. Indonesia for me was especially important because my case study in the African context is Nigeria, and Indonesia, because of its dualized primary sector, one that's dominated by agriculture and petroleum resources. Seeing that as an exemplar was quite useful for my study of Nigeria on that front. And then also in terms of development economic theory, Albert Hirschman's work on linkages was very important to my work as well. The way in which a state can support particular sectors of the economy that can generate, that go on to generate, in a sense, the most number of productive linkages with other sectors of the economy. So, for instance, taking a fiscal linkage as a state like Nigeria, using petroleum resources, or the resources that it, the public revenue that comes from petroleum, and placing those back into an industrial sector and into an agricultural sector that's expected to go on to generate other production linkages with other sectors of the economy, and how transition takes place on this basis. So just a brief background there. Now, the DSP, as it is, tends to prioritize particular elements that are late common industrialization, as well as successful state action. I've already mentioned this division of literature into economic and political schools. Why was it important to me? It was important to me as a starting point, because when we think of industrial policy in contemporary times, the DSP has been very fundamental to the revitalization of debates on industrial policy. It's, in a sense, not been, I guess, shouted from the rooftops as it should be. But when we even think of John Stiglitz's work on the post-Washington consensus, a lot of that draws very heavily on the DSP without naming the DSP. So the recognition, for instance, that you have information asymmetries that make markets imperfect, and that those require a need for a state to play a coordinating role, a lot of that came out of what was recognized to have been the success of developmental states in East Asia. Yeah. And some have, you know, made the argument that when it comes to international finance institutions, they're actually very good at appropriating a lot of the criticism and just, in a sense, reformulating new ideas that build on those without necessarily recognizing where that change has come from. And I think here, the DSP has also been very important in challenging mainstream thinking on the primacy of the market mechanism. So I think given these incremental shifts we've seen about recognizing the role of the state as an enabler, the challenge that the DSP put forward has been very instrumental to that. Not because those stories of success were not known until then, but I think there was a very opportune moment after the failure, what has been, I guess, I would argue, widespread acceptance of the failure of structural adjustment programs, there was an opening for what other ideas could work. You know, and then looking again at the success of this part of the world, I mean, some of the most impressive levels of economic transformation in recent times, in a sense, called for a rethink about the blanket dismissal of the role of state in development. But the DSP was wonderful. It had driven all this change, and even in mainstream thought, but there were some challenges that I was faced with. One was the restricted understanding of socioeconomic transformation as late industrialization, because that would limit my study of African economies that were largely agrarian. Yeah, there wasn't necessarily space to think about how, for instance, agriculture could contribute to industrial transformation. So that was, in a sense, in my moving forward with it, those are the sorts of elements I introduced to a sort of revised version of the DSP. The second challenge is the state-market dichotomy, right? That in spite of the fact that there was this recognition of the possibility of a non-antagonistic interaction between the state and the market that could lead to this level of transformation, there was still this assumption that these were two discrete spaces. There was still a lot of literature that didn't really reference how these spaces actually influenced one another in a very essential way. So for here, I'm really going to focus on the state market dichotomy element of my work. So, as I mentioned, I tried to broaden the DSP, moving from the sole focus on the industrial sector to think about structural transformation, because that would allow me to think of the role of agriculture in industrialization processes. And this is the only way in which it could be relevant for looking at African economies that were largely agrarian, actually thinking of how states were facilitating agriculture to drive manufacturing sectors. And the key one to discuss here is this notion of reintroducing economic, social, and political factors that actually underscored the state's support to structural transformation and industrial processes. Yeah, and underscored the state's support and its own very intrinsic interlinkages with other milieus, including the market. So my focus, my case study was Nigeria, as I said, and I looked at the post-colonial period especially. Now that was actually also very much influenced by the work of Mkandere that's reflected on the post-colonial period as one in which states acted in a developmentalist manner. Yeah, and I would argue that Nigeria has indeed been considered in that light, especially in the aftermath of the Biafran War, so the 1970s decade especially. And you know, some of the outcomes that underscore this is that we saw a level of manufacturing sector growth that has been at its highest level ever since, even in the period of discussion around Africa rising, Nigeria is the largest economy in Africa. It's never again achieved manufacturing sector growth at these levels again. So my discussion on, I guess, development and transition is very much focused on the structural transformation lens. So that is a limitation, admittedly. And this is also recognized in the literature, especially more critical literature, that recognizes that there were clearly major challenges with that period, including over dependence on petroleum resources. But it's quite clear that there was extensive public expenditure and investment that was quite critical to industrial policy and a developmental agenda. The developmental state agenda in Nigeria was defined by a range of characteristics. Yeah, but here I want to isolate two and use this as a sort of entry point to examine how certain factors reproduce dynamics that influenced development processes across the state and the market. One is thinking about structural transformation as development, so seeing that as how that defined what development meant in this period in Nigeria. It was quite also, I think, was quite common across the continent in the 70s to view development in this way. The second point to make is, the second factor I want to use as an entry point is thinking about the state as a surrogate capitalist. So the fact that the state played a very central role beyond directing industrial policy, actually investing in industrialization itself. Yeah. So starting with the first of these, development policy was very much underscored by structural transformation. And this is very similar, again, to experiences of developmental states. These were guided by medium to long-term development plans. Again, something quite common across the continent in the post-colonial period. But central to this, definitive of all of this entire agenda, was a key objective of industrialization. Yeah, transition development was defined by progress towards industrial economies. So elements, again, of modernization, thinking of development as westernization, these are all, very much engaged and critiqued by the post-development school, but I think nonetheless quite significant to think about when we think of the role of state in development. So in spite of the fact that we had that situation, it was very, at a superficial level, I guess, it was clear the state newly independent state was able to decide that this is how we're going to define development. There were other factors that influenced this focus on industrialization. Yeah, one of these was the experience of civil war in Nigeria. Yeah, so in the immediate aftermath of the war in 1970, in fact during the war itself, there was a need to focus on structural transformation, to energizing the manufacturing sector, because there were import restrictions in place to allow the Nigerian state conserve foreign exchange resources to be able to expend those on its needs, its security and defense needs. In addition to that, there were wider restrictions within the global space that might have been politically influenced, but nonetheless spoke to certain restrictions within the market for the Nigerian economy at the time. But also, in addition to that, that was not the only fact. That was not the only way in which conflict influenced this structural transformation agenda. Another way in which it did so was the fact that the Nigerian state felt increasingly victorious after the Biafran War, and that really energized its nationalistic tendencies. The fact that we had to focus on building the nation state of Nigeria, yeah. And doing that meant having a strong economy that was industrial, that was a member of, full-fledged member of the global political economy as an industrial state, like, you know, the metropole states, at the time. It was going to show progress, it was going to show power, and this was a very significant, important way of doing so. Second factor to bear in mind, a point I made about the state as surrogate capitalist, is the fact that, yes, industrialization was very much supported by very high levels of capital accumulation by the state, yeah, because this was needed to drive industrial policy. On the surface, again, that seems, you know, very clear and sensible, especially when we bear in mind that the Nigerian state had petroleum resources upon which to rely upon to drive this agenda. But this role of the Nigerian state was also defined by the realities of the private sector in Nigeria at the time. As a result of the colonial experience, you had private capital that had suffered severe limitations in terms of its capacity to actually drive structural transformation agenda. And I want to note here that there was a special focus on indigenous private capital. Yeah, so you had foreign capital that might have been able to drive such an agenda. Yeah, so those firms that had come settled from the metropole, from the UK specifically. But there was a recognition by the Nigerian state that to drive its structural transformation agenda, it would need to rely on indigenous private capital and not foreign capital. Not foreign capital. Yeah. And so this was very much at the heart of the other side of the coin in terms of the Nigerian state's focus on supporting indigenous private capital. On the one hand, there was a need because you didn't have a private sector that could drive that. On the flip side, this focus on the indigenous sector was because there was a mistrust of foreign capital because of the experience of colonialism. And ultimately, the state actually went on to rely very extensively on this indigenous private sector and actually engineered a whole range of indigenization and nationalization policies that went on to actually restructure the very nature of private capital in Nigeria. So key points as I wrap this section up is to say I've paid attention to the role of state in development. But even in doing so, I think it's been very important to consider the ways in which the state and the market are internally related. Yeah. So my entry point has continued to be, I'm interested in the way in which the state has engaged development processes and actually gone on to facilitate particular development outcomes. But in doing so, it is insufficient to look only at that space. It is necessary to think of how my focus of the state has been influenced by the way in which its very essence is defined by other entities such as the market, and vice versa, the very way in which the market itself has been, one could argue, constructed by that interaction with the state. So I think that on the surface, the post-colonial period has been defined as one of state-led development and accepted as such. You know, but when we look deeper at that, especially when we go into that with the intention of subverting the state-market dichotomy as the basis of our analysis, it forces us to think more deeply about the interrelatedness of these different elements of society and to think more deeply about arguments such as state-led development. What does that really mean? To unpack that a bit more. So in my work, I'm wrapping up that section, I just want to flag some African scholars that have been important to me in the work that I've done. And I do this because I think increasingly I find that I have to challenge myself to think about the presence of African voices in my work. I think especially critical African voices that advance conceptual and theoretical debate. So I think when it comes to empirical reflections, it isn't too difficult to think of how to engage with African scholars in the work that we produce, in the work that I produce. But when it comes to positioning those debates within, you know, in a sense, conceptual, theoretical debates that can be seen as requiring particular levels of depth, I think sometimes one can find that African voices are especially silenced in those spaces. That has certainly been my experience working in the field of development economics, for instance. So Claude Ake, who I've referenced quite a bit, has been quite influential for me, and it's influential because he highlighted that the state's market dichotomy is something that draws from the received disciplinary lenses that we have when we think about these processes in the African context, but I dare say even more widely. And this work was from 1981. You see a lot of debates coming up about this again in more recent times, but this is work that was done in the 1970s. And for me, sometimes it's quite surprising that I don't see more of this, not just in debates on Africa, but even more widely. I think his proposal to center the way in which elements of society are related has been very important to my analytical approach and to my attempt, in a sense, to transcend the state-market dichotomy. I think also his ideological reflection on global power structures and how these have subordinated the global south in terms of how we're able to produce knowledge is very instructive. Yeah, and that was one of the factors that actually encouraged me to think about south-south exchanges, to think about the relevance of the developmental state paradigm, which is reflecting on East Asian experiences. Of course, those reflections also draw on classical economic theory or classical development theory, which, you know, has its you know, some of its rooting in the global north as well. But I think being able to refract those through the experience, through empirical experiences in East Asia, have been very important to thinking of you know, a broader base upon which to draw in my analysis of Nigeria and even Africa more widely. Someone else that's been quite important to my work in this area is Tunde Kamkhandarure, and actually, as I'm here, he wrote in the Cambridge Journal of Economics in 2001, where he spoke about developmental states, thinking, I think people started thinking about developmental states in Africa. And I think he made a case for challenging Afro-pessimism long before the rising Africa debate, when it became, you know, the vogue to do so. He did it when there was a lot of silence about thinking differently about the African continent. I think it was important also that he allowed us to think about South-South exchanges and thinking about this debate on developmental states in Africa. And for me, it was important the way in which he did this. He looked at the African experience without without subordinating that experience to the Asian experience. Yeah, he looked at the post-colonial era to say there are some things we can draw upon here. I think it was also very important that he said we need to look empirically at processes beyond outcomes. Yeah, he spoke of the limitations of focusing only on outcomes, that we would lose, in a sense, the knowledge that comes out of looking at trial and error in the ways in which one can pursue a development agenda. And his argument was to move away from a tendency to simplistic and reductionist readings of states in Africa. And I think that's very dumb, because it was very much a lone, well, not a lone voice. I mean, there are others like Professor Bayo Lukoshi, for instance, who said we have to move away from this simplistic reading of states in Africa. But there were not many saying those or making those arguments. I think the significance of global development policy in a lot of this has also been very important, and these are things that he brought to bear and were quite important in my reflection. Again, also Professor Bayo Lukoshi, I think, has been very influential in my work in that way as well. You know, so really thinking about the significance of these global power structures of knowledge production and how those impact on intellectual and policy spaces regarding debates in Africa has been very important, and is something I've gleaned from his work. I think he also worked in the UN, and that possibly influenced him in terms of thinking of those interactions more deeply. I'm sure my time is up, so I'm going to wrap it up here. Thank you very much. Yeah.